you've been on our show before, Michael.
I have. Once before.
Do you remember the context?
Bill was leaving.
Yeah, it was.
Oh, yeah.
And then it got into Beatles versus monkeys and man. Then it was like...
Sounds about right.
Did you ever have to make up your mind and pick up on one and leave the other behind? It's not often easy and not often kind. Did you ever have to make up your mind?
Always record episode 69 with Michael Schott and with Sandra Bell.
Sing a song. If the sun refuses to shine, I don't mind. If the mountains fill in the sea, let it be.
Decide and say yes to one and let the other one ride. There's so many changes and tears you must hide. Did you ever have to finally decide? Sometimes there's one with big blue eyes, cute as a bunny, with hair down to here and plenty of money. And just when you think she's that one in the world, your heart gets stolen by some mousy little girl. And then you know you better make up your mind and pick up on one and leave the other behind. It's not often easy and not often kind. Did you ever have to make up your mind?
Yes. Now if a six turned out to be nine,
feel like that would actually be a really good segue. That's up to you if you want to kind of repeat that last little bit about Back to the Future or...
Well, I can repeat it. I don't mind. Let's see. First of all, my dog died on the 16th, Oliver, and he was a real member of the family, and we're really missing him terribly, and I got this crazy idea to try to bring him back to life with alchemy, and because actually someone else called him a Lazarus dog because it was weird. A month earlier, he almost died from a heart attack kind of thing, but he came back to life. And so he kind of became a Lazarus dog. And then he actually did die on the 16th. And so using my Back to the Future continual sync, I was thinking the first dog to time, or the first creature to time travel was a dog, and that was Einstein in the DeLorean. And if you recall in the scene where they get set up, you know, they put Einstein into the DeLorean, close it, and he, excuse me, I just got a phone call that distracted me. But so they put him in and send him off, and Marty says, you know, Jesus, Doc, you just killed Einstein. And I thought, that's a weird thing to say. And then, of course, And he's not, no, I haven't killed him. He's just gone into the future and we'll catch up to him, you know, pretty soon in 5 minutes. And so that's what happens. And so my idea was not so much to try to bring Oliver back to life, but simply to travel to the another dimension where Oliver never died. So that's basically where I'm at.
So here's just a few interesting things that I, so the fact that your phone rang while you're talking about that was funny to me because we've, Andras and I have been working on an episode of Synchronize that has kind of consumed us for the last week. Keep trying to make different edits and whatever. And in it, we do a Radio 8 Ball with Jeremy Violator Hellspawn. And while he's talking during the interview, his phone goes off. And I say, oh, it was, you know, I don't remember exactly what I said, but it's like, you know, I was at a phone call and he's saying, actually, it was an alarm to remind me to feed the dogs. So I just thought that was funny that we're talking about dogs again. But I mentioned to Michael that I've been having this really strange synchronicity with bringing the dead back to life has been a very common theme for me in the last 2 weeks, or maybe just even week. I watched the movie Solaris, the Russian version, which is, I've never seen the George Clooney
version.
It's really amazing. Also, it's basically, I want to say, obviously, it's like the third degree Masonic tracing board come to life, in the fact that they start the movie off talking about Acacia trees. And then the last shot of the movie, one of the last shots of the movie is this little kind of coffin-shaped thing with a plant growing out of it, which looks like the coffin with the Acacia tree coming out the top. And the whole thing's about bringing the dead back to life. And at some point, they just keep coming back. And at some point, there's like this really funny line where the guy's like, I'm tired of all these disgusting resurrections or something. So here's this common theme. And then two nights ago, I watched, all these people at my job keep telling me I needed to watch this cartoon called Adventure Time. So I watched an episode of it, and like what I was telling you about it, but I just realized it's characters in the cartoon are a guy and his dog. And okay. They are trying to make a formula to bring the dead back to life, and then they do it, but then they make zombies. And then at the end of the show, they perfect the formula and they just turn the zombies back into the resurrected dead. So everyone's back and healthy and happy and like nothing ever happened. So here's a guy and his dog bringing them back to life. But this other idea of Michael's, this idea of the alternate timeline of sort of having this split timeline and being able to choose between the two is really interesting to me because that's basically the theme of what I wanted to bring up with you today.
I have to interrupt you guys. I apologize, but I got Ezra here back and forth saying that he hasn't received my Skype request that it says on mine, pending contact request. And then I gave him mine, and he said it's not showing up, and so he's, like, having a hard time.
I'm going to try and add him again.
So, that dog thing with the time travel, I had my mind blown a little bit. I saw that, am I interrupting? I don't know if you guys were in the middle of something, then I interrupted you only to continue to interrupt.
No, it's okay. The only thing I'll ask is if you keep having to message with Ezra, just mute your mic while you're typing.
Right.
It's really loud in there.
Yeah, okay. So I saw that Poltergeist and E.T. came out within a week of each other. And that's interesting in the first place, but then the fact that Steven Spielberg oversaw Poltergeist to the degree that he did, so it was like called the summer of Spielberg, right? But really it was the week of Spielberg. And so, and I stopped and I was like fucking tripping on it, and this was pointed out just that they came out at the same time by Subliminal Synchrosphere in his latest post. And so I was thinking about it and thinking about it. And I'm like, fucking, like, the way that I've been relating to, like, the Kabbalistic cleat boat is as aliens, because literally they are the outside ones. So chetzonim, outside ones, the nut, right? And so I was like, well, you could take them as aliens to be either ghosts, which is the way people commonly take them, or intelligences, or whatever you're more comfortable with. But then you could take them as aliens just as easily. And so I was like, I saw the correlation between, like, E.T. and the poltergeist. And so I decided to play both films simultaneously with both volumes up. And because there's, like, a symphonic soundtrack, it just completely flowed. I would recommend it. And they're the exact same length of time. So the movies end and begin at, they are the same length, 114 minutes. But there's this dog in it. And if you look at, it looks like the same dog. And I'm not sure. I'm like, did they use the same dog while filming two movies simultaneously? It's like this golden retriever. And in E.T., you can see there's a scene towards the beginning where they cut to a picture of the dog on the mantle. And he's in this pose, like upraised with his arms, kind of like up high, like he's begging. And then they pan. And then they show the dog on the bed. And then when the poltergeist shows up in the film, you know, the dog afterwards, like, gets on the bed and then gets in that same exact stance. So it's like the dog awaiting the poltergeist in E.T. And then, you know what I mean? Like, but that's just, like, one example. There is so many fucking correlations.
It's like the dog. It's like the dog exists in both realities.
So
Schrodinger's cat is only alive in one of the realities, but Schrodinger's dog is alive in both. But it turns out that there was actually a reason why these movies are so similar, correct? That there's a common origin for them. That's what it was a screenplay that was basically, like, torn in two.
Yeah, so they came from a film called Watch the Skies. So they have the same root foundation, and that they were supposed to be the same movie. And then they branched out. And Gremlins actually came out of it, too, later on. And Gremlins is very much, like, I mean, Mogwai means demon. I mean, the Gremlins, like, they have these cocoon pods. It's totally the glyphotic nut. It's really obvious, actually, on that level. And so you can see that they all share this. And so, you know, like, E.T.'s connection to the boy, I'm spacing on his name. I should know that. It's because...
Elliot?
Elliot, like, his connection is a psychic connection, you know, but then there's, like, the psychic connection between, like, Carol Ann and E.T. somehow or something. I don't know. When watching it, you can explore it from so many different angles. It's really an exercise.
It's really an exorcist? That's another one.
I wish I could just... and add him to the call, but he's restarted and it's not
what?
It's not changing.
You're cutting out there.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Now you're back.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, he says he restarted. Same issue. MK Ultrasound not showing up when I searched add new contacts. Alan's offline and I don't have a request from you. I've used Skype in the past couple weeks though. It was working fine. Is Alan on Skype from your screen?
Yeah, I'm showing Ezra last seen online October 23rd. 5 p.m.
Wow, maybe there's, like, something weird going on.
Ezra's in a different timeline.
Yeah.
Do you guys see a black cat walk by?
Actually, there's a black cat that walks by every day, so...
There's actually a black cat sitting on the bed next to me.
Oh, he says, that's weird, I'm logged on right now. Oh, fuck, does this mean I'm dead? And then many, many questions.
Oh, shit.
Oh, shit. I love the Hoffman's razor situation we have going on. It means he's dead.
Let's see if we can bring Ezra back from the dead. Magic.
Oh, boom, there it is. Look at that.
Ezra.
You want to call him?
I'm already adding him to the call.
Bam.
Right. Yeah.
This is who we're about to give up. We're like,
no. I thought I was like dead or something.
That's what we've been talking about, man.
Jeez. Resurrecting the dead on Jupiter.
don't bring that up, man. That's crazy.
It's the first thing I thought of, actually, when you were talking about your dog. Well, actually, first I thought, I'm sorry if this is, there's no other way. I took care of a terrier for 14 years, I think. 13 years, something like that. And I was in junior high and had that die. So I know what that's like. It's terrible. The first thing I thought
he was 11.
Pet Cemetery. And then I thought of Resurrect Dead on Jupiter. Old dogs. But all dogs go to heaven. Remember that.
That's right.
It's true.
We have a golden retriever in town named Zeus, so that's a good kind of sync with Jupiter. Because whenever you call him, you say, "Hey, Zeus," he comes.
Lightning bolt up your ass, Zeus.
So, Ezra, welcome back from the dead. What was it like? Did you see a white tunnel or anything? Or
No, I was, like, communicating with my spirit mediums, and here I thought I was, like, alive and everything was normal, seemingly, you know, no different. And then, but then I was, like, invisible to everybody else, so it's kind of bizarre.
Did you forget to take your cloak of invisibility off?
Yeah, I actually, what I realized, kind of stupid. I guess I'm used to my Skype just automatically signing me online, and the offline online buttons look so similar because they're both green. So I thought I was online, and I was just looking. I was like, "God, everyone's offline. What's going on?" And then, I was offline. Anyway.
So the funny thing is, we started this call talking about contacting the dead, resurrecting the dead, and then you started messaging that you thought you might be dead, that we couldn't hear you, you couldn't hear us. So that's a really funny sync, but there is a sort of tangent to this, and maybe this is when you're saying the off and on are so similar. I want to kind of bring it to this idea. Michael had started this off by saying he just lost his dog, and he was talking about Back to the Future and the idea that you have the dog goes 5 minutes into the future. He's not really dead. He's just waiting in this other time frame. So we have this idea of perhaps this sort of split timeline. And that's kind of the theme I wanted to bring up with you guys. So maybe we can kind of take it there of here we have our, we're actually living our double split experiment right here of, are you offline or online? I got this thing in the mail the other day, and it inspired a 2-hour conversation with my wife, at the end of which I decided I wanted to do this show with you guys. So, full disclosure, I was pretty stoned, and I'm in my apartment. I'd come home from work, and I was just kind of winding down, and I looked over on my wife's desk, and there was this piece of junk mail. And what's funny is it's actually addressed to Daniel Jansen. I don't know who that is, but it's I guess this was meant for Dan, maybe not for me. But it's this catalog of cars that you can buy, some bullshit Hunter Volvo. Oh, so we have the Mars. Oh, that's interesting. So it's this is from Mars, I guess. And,
right.
And, you know, the Volvo logo being
the
Mars.
The logo, yeah.
And the Hunter as well. So it was face down. I didn't see any cars on it. What I saw was this kind of brochure with a key glued to it. And it says, scratch and match to win. It's like, looks like something you might buy, like a lottery ticket. And I walk past this thing, and my first response is like, what is this bullshit? That's my honest first reaction, like, what is this bullshit? And then in that stoned moment, I look at this, and you could win up to $20,000. And I go, huh, I wonder. You know, stranger things have happened.
Yeah.
So I scratch the thing off, and I just kind of stare at it for a few minutes because it says that I've won $20,000. And I'm staring at it going, did I just win $20,000?
Or is this a scam?
Or is it a scam? And the minute I said, or is it a scam, and then I read the fine print, and then I start to look at it more closely, and it says, if you match these three symbol amounts, my three symbol amounts being $20,000, then you are qualified to be a lucky winner by calling this number. Anyways, I didn't win. I was qualified to win. And then as I looked over the thing, I realized it's actually designed so that every brochure is a winner. Whether they're giving you an iPad or pay your mortgage for a year or $20,000, whatever the prize are, it's actually designed so that everyone is a winner.
It's heaven then.
Yeah, everyone's a winner. Step right up. But what occurs to me is in that moment where I went, did I just win? And I was like, oh, what the hell? I'll give it a chance. Then I thought I won. And then I had that moment of doubt. And Michael, you have as your Facebook icon this Dumbo holding the feather.
Oh, yeah.
Right? This idea of you can fly if you believe you can fly. And I had this thought of, did I create a sort of, you know, was I at a crossroads of timelines here where I could have won $20,000, but in the moment of doubt, did I create a timeline in which I didn't, which is a scam?
Well, yeah.
This is a very, you know, this is probably more literal than it needs to be, but I thought it was a great foundation for a conversation. And specifically, Ezra, I wanted you on this call because there's a number of things. One is that was essentially kind of your goal for your Kickstarter was about $20,000. Mm. And we had, at the end of 2012, you and I were trying to figure out how I could move out to the West Coast, and I was just to meet up with you around Portland or Bend, Oregon, and things like that. Mm-hmm. And there was something you said to me around that time as we were having trouble making this happen. You said to me, I'm sorry that you can't imagine a possibility in which this can happen. It's a idea that stuck with me, you know, was the idea that if I could imagine it, could I manifest it?
Right. And there was another piece which you may or may not recall, but while I was there, it was almost like there was this window of time, and what happened, I was just hanging out and I was, you know, working from home while I was down there. But then that opportunity ran up and I had to actually start commuting to the house where everybody else was at to do the work. And so in that commute, I discovered there was this street, I forget what it was now, but it was like Allen Drive or Allen Boulevard or something. And what it was, the house where I was staying at and the house that I was trying to travel to, they were actually really close, but they were connected by Allen Street. And the weird thing about Allen Street is that it didn't go all the way, like it didn't connect. There was like this blockade where I couldn't drive my car through. So I had to drive all the way around and it turned from like a 2 minute drive to a 15 minute drive.
It's your fault, Allen. If you could have believed the road. I see the connection. This is like Sync 101. Come on, let's you know. This is like shooting fish in a barrel.
But then I have, you know, a very practical side of me that says, well, I could have also just been stoned and gone, oh my God, I won $20,000 and stayed up all night and not showed up to work the next day, and the next day sobered up and realized, oh, that was a fucking scam, duh. Right, so there could have been that. But then, Ezra, the reason I mentioned your Kickstarter, and I, this is maybe a tough conversation, but just I want to be real for a minute, is you tried for about this amount of money, presumably with this same philosophy. I would assume that you believed you could do it, or you have this sort of, so that lack of imagination wasn't there, mm-hmm. and you did not meet your goal. So my question being, is this comparable, that you were not, for lack of a better term, you were not able to manifest $20,000 for yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Or I was considering that it's also maybe not the same consideration. Yours is more of an act of will of saying to the universe, I would like this right now, and trying to manifest that. The flip side being, this thing that came in the mail could be, in our, you know, hypothetical conversation here, could be an opportunity for a gift. So there's a difference between asking, if the universe is like your mom, you know, the great mother, and saying, hey, mom, can I have $20,000? And she says, sorry, Ezra, not right now. Mm-hmm. And then the alternative being the universe saying, hey, would you like a present? And you just have to be willing to accept it. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I totally get that. It feels very quantum, what you're proposing. It's like Schrodinger's cat, that this, like, when you're receiving that gift, you know, you just doubt that the inside of the gift box is $20,000, and so when you open it up, there's no money in it.
Yeah, yeah.
And as far as the whole act of will thing with the Music Myth Cosmos project, I mean, where I really stand with how that played out, if I can just associate for a second, there's a book called Mimetic Magic. Have any of you guys read that?
No, sir.
No.
Okay. Mimetic Magic. Well, basically, what the author is talking about, he's saying that that essentially everything that's happening in the meme sphere, which is basically every idea that gets propagated and becomes viral, it's basically what it is. It's containing a spirit within it, and so if the meme that you're propagating does not fit into the receptor sites of the audience or the basically the recipient of whoever it is that you're projecting it towards, then it basically won't take hold. And so Mimetic Magic is about learning how to create memes that will plug in, so that certain, for example, like a virus, if you wanted to convince somebody of something that they typically would not be willing to believe, the first thing you need to do is to make the pill easier to swallow, essentially. You need to, you know, the idea that a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down.
Oh yeah.
Right. So you have to make it tasty enough, but it also, even if it's tasty, if it's essentially poisonous, or if it's just basically incompatible with the host, it's still going to get regurgitated and spat out. And my sense was that whatever it was about the signal we were propagating, it wasn't speaking to people. And so I was wondering, well, what's that about? And as I, you know, the other big point in Mimetic Magic that he makes is that the magician himself has to actually believe in the meme that he's propagating. If he doesn't, it's not going to take hold no matter how sweet it is, because it has the host where it's departing from isn't even really hosting it, so it's just free floating, and it doesn't get charged with the power of will. And that was definitely an issue, because, you know, with the whole Music Myth Cosmos thing, yeah, I did have the will to manifest $20,000 with Steve, to where we then would have been able to play out a script of hanging out together on the regular and making sync videos and having a blast. But the actual information and content of the video, it was still kind of vague and not fully formulated. So actually what I've been doing this whole year, I've been going back inward and really looking at the Tone Color Alchemy project and trying to understand what's the value there and what I need to let go of in order to make room for new material. And actually, it's good timing that you invited this, Alan. I haven't really communicated to you, but I've started working on a book. I ended up getting a 6-month grant from a family member to work on my book. So I'm in the process every day now. I'm working for like 6 to 8 hours. I just go to the cafe every morning. I wake up at 7 and I just have a cup of coffee and work. And so I'm actually beginning to formulate a way more cohesive and more integral thesis than was really present in Beginnings of the Cosmos. So I feel like, you know, I've really learned from the failure of that project, and I'm starting to formulate something new.
Well, that's pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Can you disclose the kind of basis for the book at all, or do you feel that that's not something you want to do?
Yeah, no, I'd be happy to. The basis of it. So what I realized is that the origin of Western music is Pythagorean. And Pythagoras, he was into the study of harmony of the spheres, the sounding of the heavens on earth. And so what I'm doing is, from the ground up, I'm actually creating this pedagogical map of music theory of Western tonal harmony, which is really only about 250, 300 years old. And I'm showing how it developed conceptually through the lens of alchemy and astrology. So I'm creating visual representations of that and the text to accompany that. And then basically the book is about active imagination and dream analysis and dream interpretation. And so I'm using Jungian analysis to look at melodic and harmonic fragments within pieces of music that are connected to myths, for example, film scores. So if you're watching a movie and you feel like a swell of emotion come up and you're noticing, wow, it's connected to both the thematic content of the myth of this movie and also to the music that I'm listening to, then for me the question is, how is it that those musical notes are evoking that emotion? And so I'm attempting to create a mode of understanding for people who don't really know anything about music theory, that from the ground up they can learn the basics and eventually, you know, have some more solid foundation in music analysis and film analysis.
Huh. So before you got on, I was telling these guys about so Poltergeist and E.T. came out within a week of each other in like 1980 and or 1981 maybe, I forget. Anyways, they're the same exact length of time. They're 114 minutes. And so I played them simultaneously with both volumes up and found that the symphonic score from one of them is John Williams and one of them is Goldsmith, Jerry Gold, no, that's something Goldsmith. Anyways, they're so complementary, and I was tripping out on the fact that you have these, because they're so symphonic, they actually melded and it flowed in a way that I wasn't expecting it to. I was expecting far more of a clash when you have these, because, you know, the symphonic music is very overt, you know, and so if you have two things playing that are both like that, it seemed like they would really interfere, but I was amazed at how well they went together. It was almost like a composition in and of itself. And the way that in one scene, if it had a different, what you would take as a different, the music changed your feeling of the scene. So like if you're playing one film with another film and it's very like dark or something, and then you see something that's supposed to be light in the other scene, but you're meeting it through the lens of darkness. It's really an interesting, kind of experiment.
Yeah, I immediately associated to the dark side of the moon in relation to the Wizard of Oz, and just like the taking of two different mythic landscapes, one musical and one, you know, cinematic, and like fusing them together and how they overlap perfectly. But I also thought of the idea of Alan's key and how, like, if two songs are in the same key, you can superimpose them on one another and they may actually be in harmony.
That made my skin crawl. I mean, in a good way. I mean, like the hair on the back of my neck. That's cool. There's something about that. Mm. Huh. I keep having a perpetual key sync, you know, coming, you know, and that's just kind of that thing where something goes together, like it's meant to be, and they connect and click and whatnot.
That's really, so last night I showed Joe Alexander Titanic with the downward spiral. And there's a scene in Titanic where the keys to Leonardo DiCaprio's handcuffs are put in this guy's pocket and he walks out of the room, right? But when the guy hands him the keys, there's like a music shift and a song change. And I immediately was like, huh, what's like just thinking about the obvious symbolism of a key and a lock, but it didn't occur to me that like for something to be in key, I mean, that's really obvious now, but I mean, it was totally in key. That's, you know, like even though it's a visual thing, it actually like visual and auditorily, it's almost like there's like a visual key that aligns with the auditory key or something.
Right. And there's like, I think in neuroscience, they talk about these lock and key, like there's a, like the receptor sites or something that you can, like dopamine receptors, you know, if you there's like a certain function where like certain molecules fit perfectly into our brain to create bliss.
There's also an issue of timing here, is that which is another musical issue, right? It's what key are you in and what's your timing. So on this scratch thing, the, as I mentioned, the key is basically crazy glued to the scratch off, so it's be very hard to pull off, and I'm considering at this moment that it's just sort of the timing wasn't right, the key isn't there yet, because realizing this morning that the other side of this sheet is the Volvo logo, which is the Mars circle and arrow, I have this synchronicity that I've meant to blog about the longest time, but I had months and months ago was walking down the street towards my apartment here, and in the middle of the street I kicked this metal thing and I looked down and it's this wrench, and it was a small little wrench, and it was really powerful to me because I had, just before I left the house, I don't remember why I was looking this up, but I was looking at the alchemical glyphs for certain metals, and I found that there was an alternative Mars iron glyph that's not just the circle and arrow, but one that looks very much like a wrench. It's a circle with a stick coming off and then a kind of staple, if you can imagine. So basically, you know, you picture like a simple wrench where you have one side is made for working the bolts, like almost like a ratchet style, and the other side is almost like a claw. So I was looking at this image for, I mean, longer than I probably care to admit, probably about a good 40 minutes to an hour staring at this thing going, why have I never seen this alternative symbol for it? And it was from an old alchemical book, and I was like, why have I never seen this, and pondering what it means. And I decided at some point, for whatever reason, I had to leave the house. I'd walk away from the computer, go out, and as I'm coming back home, I trip over this thing in the street, which is the exact same shape I had been staring at for almost an hour.
Yeah, that's cool.
And I pick this thing up, and I just sort of hang it on the wall next to my computer, and I say, I have no doubt that there's going to come a point I'm going to need this wrench. I don't know when or why, but I feel like I'm going to need this thing. And I just hung it on the wall and let it wait until it was needed. And months later, so most of the time I moved to this apartment. When we moved here, we couldn't bring our bed with us. Like, we just carrying, you know, trying to transport all our stuff, that was something we didn't have room for. So we've had just this mattress for a while and trying to figure out, you know, did we want to invest in a new bed and things like that. So finally, we invested in a new bed, and we get this, most fun, this really nice bed frame off Craigslist, like a canopy style, really gorgeous bed that was very cheap. And we pick up the stuff, bring it back, but then it was a bigger size mattress, so we couldn't even put our mattress on this thing. So it's been sitting in the corner of the room, disassembled, and finally, we get the new mattress, all this sort of stuff, and I start to put the bed frame together and realize oh man, there's no, this requires a wrench, and there's no tool that came with it that we need. And I glance over at the wall and I go, I betcha. And it was the exact, size wrench that I needed. And I just, so I put the thing together and said thank you very much to the wrench. And so it's this idea of a magical tool might come into your life, or this opportunity might come into your life, but there's also the idea of the timing might not be right. And Ezra, you were talking about the idea of music, myth, cosmos, that perhaps the idea wasn't fully formulated. And
yeah.
I've been having the same realization in the last few weeks with Suicide Kings. I had started writing this book, and I was really, I put in hundreds of pages and felt really good about it. And then it came time to put out Sync Book 2, and I had to put Suicide Kings on hold. And it's been almost a full year that I had to put this thing on hold, because after Sync Book 2 came out, I went into working on this Yoga Gospel of Thomas book that should be coming out in the next month, and all these different projects that kind of flung in my face, and I started to really resent them, because I'm saying, man, I'm hundreds of pages into this book that I want to finish, and there seemed almost from a kind of marketing perspective, tomorrow is the 50th anniversary of JFK's death. And I was like, this would have been perfect to have had ready for when everyone's, talking about JFK and things like that. But two realizations have come into my mind recently. One is that in the last year, while I haven't been able to finish the book, I've come across so much more material from different psychology, like the psychology of James Hillman, and just different perspectives that could flesh this out a lot more, and kind of twist the thesis a little bit into something a little more grounded and a little more, I don't know, I think a truer sense of what I'm really trying to say. So this year of, instead of writing, doing more research has really added to it. And then there's the other idea, is that even though this is the 50th anniversary of JFK, one of my major syncs with the concept of the King Kill is the number 51. And I realized, oh, well, of course I couldn't put out a book about the King Kill 51 on the 50th anniversary. It requires another year, so you can do it for 51. And I realized that just in the last week, and I'm like, I feel so much better about it. Oh, of course, the sync wasn't there yet. And now the time is.
There's this van parked right across the street from me right now. It's with a crazy. It's brightly painted, and I just emailed the picture to Alan. I don't know if you've gotten it yet, but it says yes on 522, and so that's like the 50th anniversary and the 22nd right there.
Oh yeah. That's a pretty crazy van.
Yeah.
And I love that it's covered in these spirals, because that's a big part of my theory there.
Hey, a question for you. When you were describing the wrench, the symbol that inspired the discovery of the wrench, it sounded to me like the symbol for Chiron. Are you familiar with that one?
That's like a key, right? It's got the two triangles, kind of half triangle.
Looks almost like the letters OK, right? It's like a circle at the top with almost like a lowercase K coming down from it. That looks exactly like a key. That's not what I'm talking about. Let me see if I can find it. If you guys want to,
I keep visualizing the Led Zeppelin cover. Whatever that was, it sounds like a discography or something, but where they had the signs, like the crop circle thing.
Oh, okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just seems like there's a lot of things attached to that one.
Well, it's also, if it's Mars, it's a phallic. That's you know, and a wrench. I mean, come on, that's slang.
Sure. For
penis. So
right, and the fact that this would be part of my bed with my wife was not lost on me. It was definitely not lost.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that this is, you know, to sort of, that what would this be used for, but to make a sort of space that my wife and I could enjoy.
Alan, I'm curious what James Hillman you're reading.
The Dream in the Underworld.
Just an incredible book. The Myth of Analysis. I think Myth of Analysis. It's an incredible book about Eros. Yeah, he was cool. He was very. His style was very free. He doesn't. He's kind of his own thing. Like it almost feels like he's making things up as he goes along. Sometimes, but it doesn't matter because it makes so much sense. It's like. He's an explorative character.
I mostly know his work through Pacifica University, which is, you know, I guess he was like, it's in Carpinteria, California, but it's a graduate university for mythological studies in counseling psychology. And I've got a few friends who graduated from there. So they have a lot of good things to say about Hillman. And it's like, he's one of those characters that I've looked at peripherally, but definitely want to dive into his work more deeply.
Yeah, I mean, so basically, you know, what I really am trying to write about is the symbolism of the alchemical king dying and being reborn, a journey into the underworld, and the concept of ego death and different sort of corollaries from there. So it was important for me to see. Sort of his approach to the underworld, which is a different one, and the other actually surprisingly major key for me in this was really researching the ideology of Charles Manson, and not, I don't mean this in a positive way, I think I discussed this a few episodes ago. I don't mean this in a positive way, but to show how we can come really close to an ideal, but be off target, let's say, in the sense that, like, you know, Jay Kotze talked about the 9/11 Stargate, and then you have, you know, it's a very obviously brutal event, whether you want to come at it from a conspiratorial angle or official story angle, it almost doesn't matter. Here you have a fuckload of people dying, and it leads us into all these wars, and it's a very violent act. And to associate this with a transcendence is something that makes sense on a sort of level of a dichotomy and an almost paradox. It makes sense to me on that level, and at the same time, it's something I struggle with, of how do we take something so horrific and associate it with something so wonderful. Well, in researching the ideology of Charles Manson, you see, what I realized is people who took that concept into a very dark place. And this is something David's referenced this in the idea of a very cathartic point of view, where you have the tree, but it's the tree as if through a glass darkly. It's a slightly off kilter, darker version of it. And everything that I've found in the assassination of JFK and 9/11 and all these things really points to this transcendence. But there's this very obvious darkness and brutality to it. And Charles Manson, when they were killing people, they were saying, using expressions of killing the ego. They said, they used the expression, or it's a kind of chilling expression, that by killing someone, they brought them into the now. So when we, you know, have a Kotzian 9/11 Stargate and all about living in the now, this idea of how you could put this in a literal death or literal violence instead of a more grounded and abstracted way, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I've been really focused on this for years, on this idea of frozen time blocks, you know, which I've blogged about off and on for years. And, you know, the basic concept is that the only thing, you know, reality is basically a bunch of frozen time blocks, very much like a motion picture is really just a bunch of little rectangles. Our experience of reality is exactly the same, except it's three-dimensional. And our consciousness is what creates this fourth dimensional appearance of time. And so our consciousness is going from one frozen time block to another, and we perceive this as the passage of time. So if you want to be in the now, you're literally frozen in an ice cube of reality, you know, forever. Yeah. And to me, that's death, you know, frozen, dead, and in
Jack.
The now.
Jack at the end of The Shining, is that?
Right, oh yeah, exactly.
That's him in the now.
Yeah. Well, and I've had dream experiences that are like that, where I'm like horrified because I realize that there's no beginning or ending spatially or temporally to the space that I'm in, and it just completely freaks me out, especially if it's not a pleasant environment, which typically it hasn't been in my experience.
You mean physically outside of the dream?
No. So, like, I mean, to give an example, I had this dream one time. I was basically in this it was a building, but there was just hallways and staircases, and so as I was moving from one hallway into the next hallway, and I could take lefts or rights, or I could go up and down various staircases, but there was I could just feel in my body this like direct gnosis or direct like certainty that there was no end to this space. And I had no idea how to get out. And coupled with all that, I was like, I was in a state of lucidity, which meant that I was, my consciousness was like inside of the dream body and awake. So it felt very similar to being like in this space right now, like where I feel like I'm conscious and awake and embodied. But then when I woke up, I was just like, oh, like thank God, back to like my normal everyday mundane life. But it's kind of a trip when you realize that actually what's keeping us, you know, what's keeping the sense of continuity and the lack of eternity is basically an illusion. It's the sense that, oh, I was born and I'm going to die, and that's the beginning and the end. Whereas in fact, the closer reality is that consciousness is basically consciousness is having an eternal experience through the mediums of the body.
Right. Well, that was the whole concept of the replication of the tree. Was that to truly embrace what the tree implied means non-locality, energetically. And so the fear of non-locality, of not being able to completely identify where you are in space and time, is what drives us out of that fear to project our matrix self, so which is a substitute reality. And so it's out of that, because we're mimicking an actual pattern, but because it entails birth, growth, decay, and death on a perceptual level, as far as like an objectification of those things, and rather than just an immersion of the flow of what's actually taking place, that removal from the perception is, you know, you'll see evidence where it's not a true stable structure, it's a relatively stable structure, and so it's always collapsing upon itself. And it does it like in a secular way, both within one's lifetime and on a mass collective scale in terms of empires. Kind of a trippy idea, but I like it.
Wow.
Yeah, that's very cool. Wow.
And Alan, I saw you just sent the image of the Mars symbol.
Correct. Yeah.
So it looks like, to me, it looks like the like I've seen certain sigils. So I'll have like the beginning point circle, and then the various lines moving to the different spirits that are associated with, if you're like using a magic square, for example, it would have some sort of geometry based on the pattern, and then the endpoint would either be like this diagonal line or like a circle like that. So that was my first association when I saw it. It's interesting.
Huh. Yeah, I don't remember ever seeing that.
Yeah, I've found similar glyphs just doing different searches. You know, different different like Google image searches, and I've been able to find things like some variations on this, but it's just still something that I'm not really, it's not something I see very often. It's a very, very interesting take.
What's been a huge focus in my studies is the arrow recently. So the section of the Zohar that we've been looking at, basically I couldn't help but see the, like, you know, Yesod is taken by the Golden Dawn as the moon, right? So it's always has this crescent, and the way that they face it is generally not like sideways, but like 2001 style or flip that, you know? And, I love how the pathway in between Yesod and Tiferet is, for the Golden Dawn, is taken as Sagittarius as temperance. And so you can literally see the arrow of Sagittarius meets Yesod as the bow, which is likened to a rainbow, and is likened, like, all through the stuff we read, they liken Yesod to this bow. And so, and what are you looking at? You'll probably like this, Michael, that, you know, they take the base of the tree, not to be the like, Malkut is taken as the feet, but it's generally considered to be the tip of the penis. And so, for Yesod, then, to be like a bow, and for there to be this arrow, kind of, you know, suggests, you know, I think you know where I'm going with this. So, I don't know, I thought that was kind of interesting.
Also, I've got a lot of rainbow bridge sinks right now, because when you get these days when a dog dies, everyone is suddenly showing rainbow bridge poems to you, and it's like, get out of here with the rainbow bridge, you know, but it's interesting. We actually, when a neighbor comes over and says, this poem really helped me when my dog died, you know, I go, thank you. And Barnes says, I was just about that bridge, you know, in Laconer, because in Laconer there really is a literal bridge named the Rainbow Bridge, and that made me kind of go, huh, maybe there is a literal rainbow bridge, but somewhere.
Yeah, I have the eeriest feeling around just the you know, kindergarten observation that dog is God backwards, and that the way that we relate to Sirius, or the way that, you know, apparently the quote-unquote elite relate to Sirius, is very much like, you know, it's like worshiping the thing that's the interface or something. It's like bowing down to the thing that's obviously very high and very amazing, but it's, you know, it's like more Keter than it is Ein Sof, if you know what I mean. It's more the emanation and not the source itself. So, you know, it's like as high as you can. That's something that comes up a lot in Patanjali in the Yoga Sutras, is like as high as you can get, always know that it's always beyond that. It's because anything that's like an influence is never the thing, because, or not the thing, but God itself. God itself is never an influence or an intelligence. All the intelligences are of God. So, just a thought.
Well, you know that it would be untrue if I were to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher.
It's just because it's the basis of comparison. If you get that high, how could there be anything higher, you know?
Well, that's like, so you've got to light a fire, and
they got an iron in the fire, Mars.
Yeah. And then I keep, you know, going back to the Twin Towers as being a fire ritual, and then the 777, you know, the burning of the tower is kind of like burning the reality that, you know, and the whole world changed. not for the better, but he did.
Sure. It's the moon card in the rider deck. You know what I mean? You got Sirius in front of the two towers as Anubis.
Yeah, yeah. Jeez.
Well, that's just it. I mean, these are obviously nodes of great transition. And by great transition, I mean a very, very large-scale transition. The question being, and this gets us into a more dense dualistic conversation, but is it a good transition? Like, you know what I'm saying? How do we distinguish between? It's that's why I kind of come back to the Dark Crystal. You know, change, sometimes good, sometimes bad.
Sometimes good, sometimes bad. Excuse me while I squat in front of y'all.
God, I haven't seen that in so long, man.
That's funny, actually, that you'd say that, because last night I decided to take three large collages and put them together into one, like a puzzle, and my computer could barely fucking handle it, and it shut down in the middle of the process like 10 times or something. But anyways, I did this whole thing, and I put it all together, and I was satisfied with it, and then I took an image of Agra's face, and I wanted to just put it to help bridge it, and then it, like, shut it down in a worse way, and it gave me like a window that I've never seen come up before out of all the times I've used Photoshop. And so I just like was like, okay, no, I'm satisfied, that's fine. But it ended on Agra. It was like, does Agra belong in here? And it was like, no, Agra doesn't belong in here.
What is an auger? Isn't an auger like a tool?
I don't know, but Agra is what like surrounds the Taj Mahal.
Oh, interesting.
And I forget, I knew at one point what it meant in Sanskrit, the name of the place. I guess I could look it up. But what's fascinating about Agra is that, you know, the Taj Mahal is so fucking beautiful and perfect, you know. And Agra surrounding it is like one of the filthiest places in all of India. It's like extremely poor. Tons and tons and tons of leprosy. And so, like, you go from this thing that's like the, you know, it's like the Klipo surrounding the tree. It's like
Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon. I don't know how that necessarily relates to Agra of the Dark Crystal, but I'm sure it could pretty easily.
I've been meaning to rewatch the Dark Crystal just to see. We talked, I guess, almost 2 weeks ago now. We talked about the movie Melancholia as it corresponds to the alchemical etching, the Melancholia One.
Durr, yeah.
And what occurred to me is, if you look at the alchemical etching, there is this kind of polished stone. And what's very obvious is that five-sided, almost Superman diamond is facing the meditator. Okay? You see that kind of diamond, that five-pointed diamond shape. And I was kind of looking at this etching for a while, and I immediately thought of the scene in the Dark Crystal where they sap the life essence from the pod people. And the thing that they use looks remarkably similar, or I'm making an association in my mind. Again, I've been meaning to rewatch Dark Crystal, because I realized staring into that shape and kind of being sapped of your life energy, and here you have this expression of melancholia almost having you meditate on that same plane, I thought was very interesting.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to watch it with Saucer Full of Secrets. Just saying. So, did you know it's a bat in the etching that's holding up the sign that says Melancholia 1?
Mm-hmm.
So, that I didn't know until just recently. It kind of tripped me out a little bit.
What does bat symbolize?
Well, I mean,
it's Batman and Superman. You have the Superman shape, and then right above it, the bat.
Yeah, and then the whole thing is like you could look at it as like the striving towards the Ubermensch on that level.
Did you hear about the Bat Kid who saves San Francisco? That
yes.
Make-A-Wish Foundation thing that was like went viral for one day. And anyway, the kid was 5, and so there's another 5, and then the bat.
Yeah. So I just mentioned to Amy, just 2 days ago, I saw a kid wearing a Superman shirt with a Batman sweater over it, and I told her about your theory, Michael. She thought it was interesting.
I'm interested in that Melancholia image with the bell above Magic Square.
Yeah.
It reminds me of something. I had made a post on the Music Myth Cosmos blog some weeks ago. And basically what I was pointing at was there's like Lieber, 77? No, what is Zion? It was, I'm going to have to pull this up. Just like bookmark that. You guys continue. I'll pull this up for you.
77 is Lieber-Roz.
Lieber-Roz, right? No, it's not 77. That's why I cut myself off. It's the number of Zion. Zion in Hebrew. If you one of you guys can
pick. 70.
70. Is that what it is? Hold on. It's 67. Seven. There it is. 67.
Oh, you mean if you spell out the letter?
If you spell out Zion, yeah.
Zion Noon.
Yeah, if you guys check that out and compare it to the Melancholia image. The word bell, they say like the root origin of the word is Baal, which means Lord, and the idea of like the ringing of the bell being the sounding of the Lord, or the sound of authority, and also the idea of resonance. And this post, what I was trying to get across is essentially that Crowley had written this book, Lieber 67, called The Sword of Song, and in it he actually describes his relationship with Alan Bennett, who's the original creator of the tone color system. He was also Crowley's first medical instructor, and he mythologizes it through this sort of the format of like a Vedic myth. But what I was doing was I took the magic square that he put on the cover of his book and rearranged it in terms of the tone color attributions that we would have seen in Bennett's system that Crowley completely left out of his system. And so it was this, sort of this fusion of the two. And interestingly, in 777, like one of the only associations that Crowley doesn't include is Bennett's tone color system, which only found its way into the Golden Dawn lineage through Paul Case. Some years later.
Oh, that's because it was later in the first place. Mm-hmm. He complains about that a lot. I don't know if it was, I think it was Magic Without Tears or something, but one of his much later books, he was complaining about how incomplete 777 was in general, and how it was such an, he should have done that particular book of correspondences at the end of his magical career rather than at the beginning.
For sure. So I'm sure there's other things missing, but it definitely is. As somebody who was interested in color stuff, it always caused me that was missing, and that his own teacher, who initiated him into magic, would have surely introduced Crowley to the idea at some point. But it seems like Crowley left it out, and I wonder if part of that was despite him, because that was bad some formulation.
You mean Israel Regardi? Yeah.
No. Well, from what I've read, I could be mistaken, but my understanding was that Bennett was one of
Bennett, yes.
Yeah, totally. Alan Bennett, yeah. And so the reason I brought this up was in the Melancholia image that you guys shared with me. It's a 4x4 square Kamea, which is the same as how Crowley spells out his name. You'll see in the image in the blog post I sent you, if he arranged it to where he spells his name, Aleph, Lamed, He, Yod, Samek, Tet, Hey, Resh, Hey, Kaf, Re, Ayin, what is it? Vav, Lamed, Hey. And when you add that up together, it spells out his name as 666. 6.
That's interesting.
It's a great innovation. So I realized there was a musical melody with that, and I was playing piano one night and just playing it out.
So that's what's down here at the base of this, is you're literally translating that. So on this page,
I'm translating Crowley's name through his own spelling of it as 666 into musical notes. Yeah,
that's pretty cool. Have you seen a book by Daphne Moore called The Rabbi's Tarot? It's kind of hard to find and examples of where they show directly just the 22 arcana relating to the letters and then showing how they translate in terms of musical notes, like traditionally. Have you seen that before?
Well, that's actually the foundation of the whole tone color alchemy system that I do. There's a link there, but I created a glyph that combines the center of the rose cross, which is that the rose lamen, the 22 Hebrew letters with their color attributions. And then I've combined that with the tone color wheel, which is all of the Golden Dawn's corresponding astrological symbols, so the seven planets and the three elements and the 12 signs, and how they correspond to the rose lamen. So, and then I wrote the music notes in there so you can see them.
So your source for the musical notes is the Golden Dawn as well? Or where did you... Because I know that there's some difference of opinion there sometimes.
What there is, there's the King scale. There's four different scales of color, but the King scale is the one that I use. And I use that because it's the King scale is the one that's featured in the attributions to the letters on the Rosicrucian symbol, the Rose Cross, which is, been incorporated into one of the magical weapons of the Golden Dawn. And I also know that it would have been one of the primary attributions, because Paul Case, who was a member of the New York chapter of the Golden Dawn back in like the early 20th century, when he split off from the Golden Dawn, created his own group, the Builders of the Edom, he moved out to Los Angeles and started that lodge. And he built his entire tarot system off of these color correspondences. And if you go to the BOTA website, you can see them spelled out really, really clearly.
Cool. Yeah, he's great. I did a couple to a few years of with the BOTA studying, and I found it kind of limiting, mainly because what most of their meetings entail is taking in a lecture, and then it's more of like a social group after the fact.
Right.
Than it is.
Yeah, I've been to the lodge one time, and I was like, yeah, I could realize like the lodge itself wasn't something that was attractive to me, but the magical correspondence that they're working with was just, it has a lot of integrity within the imagery, the tarot, and the way that you color the cards. There's just a lot of like the whole idea that the individual colors in a plate on a tarot card were each informed, like the meaning of those colors were informed by the cards, who each had their own like color, that one color per card. So there was this microcosm macrocosm thing that's happening in the way that the colors are designed that were really beautiful to me.
So I've been wondering, and I posed it to somebody else, but in Melancholia, in the film Melancholia by Lars von Trier, which is obviously inspired by got some tone.
Hey guys, I have to step out for a minute. I'll
sure,
be right back.
Sure, that's fine. I just want to mention one thing real quick. So, in Durer's etching of Melancholia 1, when you're pointing out the 4x4 square, which you're connecting to Aleister Crowley, if you spell it with an I at the end, is that what I'm looking at? And there's an extra E, Aleister.
That's how he spelled it, yeah.
That's how he did it. So if you watch the film Melancholia, you can see right when it starts part two of Claire's section, it shows a window that's got 4x4, it's a 4x4 square, And then right after that, they show you a bunch of chocolates that are laid out as a 4x4 square. Claire takes one of the chocolates and puts it on Justine's pillow, which Justine later, apparently, we infer that she moved to the bedside. But I was wondering about the fact that, I mean, I'm playing the Smashing Pumpkins' Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness over Melancholia, what the connection is in terms of, literally, my thought was like color tone alchemy of having to do with this Jupiter square and how they're relating to it.
Totally. It makes me wonder which chocolate she chose so we could see which musical note like would correspond and see if it's this, if in any way relates to the key of the song of the Smashing Pumpkins song.
I looked at it and I compared the two of the one she took out from what would be taken as I recall, it's the bottom row, but it's not really the bottom row because if you look at the writing on the chocolates, you can see that they're actually facing the opposite way. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, are you familiar with Durer's magic square that he used in that particular etching?
No, I'm not. I'm actually really curious about what the symbolism of this etching is all about.
Yeah, it's a total mindfuck, because not only it does the thing that a magic square is supposed to do, where if you go in any direction, you get the same number, which I believe is 37. Don't quote me on that, but I think that might be what it is. But at the bottom of the thing, you can get, 15, 16 or something like that? Basically, you get the year in which he did the etching is contained in the square.
Wow.
Which is kind of impressive. As if it wasn't impressive enough in the first place that it's like a very, very complex magic square.
It just makes me so happy that there's a bell hovering right above it.
I can't figure out how it is that the most complex math is actually the earliest. Because what you can do with a magic square when you fold it into a cylinder and you can create the spiral... and mini magic squares, that's a phenomenon of the planet. Traditional, like Babylon, what they call the Babylonian magic squares, you know, is that you can do these things with it that like are so advanced, and yet this is some of the earliest math we've ever come across. How is the earliest the most advanced? I mean, it's another example of that kind of phenomenon, you know.
Well, I was just looking right next to the bell. There's a sand hourglass, that's the word. And right, so like a measurement of time, but then even right next to that is the scales. So you have on either side like the scales, which for me, a part of the thing I'm writing about in the book right now is that scales are a means of measurement. So in the musical scales, there's the two ways of thinking about the word scale is one as the intervals of the scales on a snake, and the other way is as the measure the balancing scales. And so I go into detail about the reason that's relevant in terms of the basic foundations of music theory. But it's interesting to me that you have all elements of music really present there. You have the bell, which is the tone. You have the scales, which is the organization of tones in certain interval patterns. And then you have the measurement of time, which accounts for the passage of time over which scales can be assembled.
Huh.
I love that idea. I've been meditating on these sort of symbolic puns, like things like seeing in a movie, seeing someone holding a champagne flute, like the glass would be called a flute. But that being like making them a resonator of the musical instrument or being a resonator of Pan or something like that.
Wow. That's the end of Tim Burton's Batman. That's the last thing that happens, right? Hands her the champagne in the car and then says Batman's going to be a little late. You remember that? And I was thinking about the symbolism of the champagne from earlier, that there's this repeated champagne thing in Tim Burton's Batman. Batman is fucking loaded with synchronicity. My God, Tim Burton's Batman, big time.
So yeah. So here you have the on this Durer's Melancholia 1, you would maybe that... Oh, Ezra, the bat, bats are... stereotypically make their homes in bell towers, right?
Oh, right.
Bat opposite the bell.
And what's bat backwards?
Tablature. Oh, that's great.
I thought it was a reference to a tab of acid. That's the only way I can approach Batman. So, oh shit, what was I gonna say?
I also like the hourglass because we have the scary black widow spiders around, and they have like these little red hourglasses on their backs, and a spider represents time to me, or kind of, I don't know, the Matrix, something about, you know, the web.
Oh, totally.
Spinning the web.
Huh.
Michael, I was thinking about Black Widow this morning, last night before I went to bed. My next door neighbor told me that there was a couple hundred pound black bear in the tree right in front of my porch the other day.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, why is it that the guy from New York, whenever he goes anywhere, actually encounters the things to nature that everyone says, oh, you'll never see that. When I went to Washington State with you guys a few years ago, I encountered the wolf. When we went to Idaho 2 years ago, I had the black widow in my bed.
Wait, was that was the alleged wolf and the alleged black widow?
Hey, let me tell you something.
I didn't see it. And those could have been coyotes. I don't know. No, those were definitely wolves. You could hear it. It's true.
No. Dave, you weren't there. I'm talking about the year before, a year or two earlier, where we went to Mike went was called Concrete Washington. That
yeah.
was called.
Uh-huh.
And I stepped outside for a cigarette. Everyone's inside this cabin. I step outside at night. And this giant black wolf starts walking up to me.
Oh, what?
And Melissa's standing there, and she's facing the other way. I'm like, get inside right now. Get inside right now. And she's like, what? And I'm like, just get the fuck inside. So we run inside, and I say to everyone, and I'm like, and everyone's
oh,
like, what's...
He's like, eyes look out. There's a fucking giant black wolf.
and we're all
like, get out of here.
And they go, no, the next door neighbor has a black dog. You just saw the neighbor's black dog. You're just a paranoid city boy. And I'm like, no, motherfucker, it was a wolf. And like, oh, no, you don't understand. So the next day is daylight, and we're outside, and then the neighbor's black dog comes over, and like, see, that's the neighbor's dog. I'm like, yeah, except that's not what I saw. I didn't see some little fucking black dog. I saw this thing. It looked like the thing from Neverending Story, or I've never actually seen the Harry Potter movie, but the clip of it where the wolf comes out of the bushes while Harry Potter's sitting on a bench, and someone used it in a sync video, and I was like, that is what I saw, that right there. But that exact movement, that exact face, that body, that everything, that is what I saw.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, yeah. Oh, we didn't see it. I'm like, well, I saw it.
And you know what you saw. And you saw what you saw. And so that's that.
That was a werewolf, man.
We heard so many wolves the last sink cabin year, as I thought you were talking about. I'm surprised I don't remember you telling the story after we were surrounded by wolves.
Well, I was too busy getting made fun of for saying there was a black widow in my bed, and everyone's like, no, you didn't really see a black widow. And Justin Morgan draws it and goes, listen, you didn't see a black widow. It must have looked like this. And I'm like, well, that's what it looked like.
Why is it so unbelievable that you could see a black widow? I see them, you know, pretty often, you know.
You totally could, you know.
But we...
I'm just here to talk you out of your experience, Alan.
Exactly. Motherfuckers won $20,000. This is what I'm trying to tell you.
I'm just thinking about the fact that bats sleep upside down, and all the correspondences with Bateman. What's his fucking name? Batman. It's the fucking Batman. Christian Bale. So Christian Bale is in The Machinist, where he's playing a hangman game. That ends up saying killer, does it, I think? And then he realizes he's a killer because of the hangman game. So the way a movie centers around a hangman game. And then in Dr. Parnassus, you have Heath Ledger shows up as the hanged man card. They pull the hangman card, find Heath Ledger, who's the Joker, you know, the opposite of Batman,
right.
Something like that. It's the whole thing with, like, St. Peter and Mem as the Hanged Man. I just find it interesting that, like, I mean, I looked at this Melancholia etching so many times and never really, like, recognized that it's the wings of the bat that fucking Melancholia 1 is written on. And then here you have the dog laying right below the stone, and you have what appears to be this, like, star or shooting star in the background with this rainbow. And it's like, I just see Sirius.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, sure. Like, it's just, it feels...
I thought that bright star shape next to the bat was the bat signal. You know, like, how you get Batman's attention.
Whoa! No, I didn't think of that. I love that. It's like, he's, like, totally they're sending up the bat signal. Wow.
Yeah.
Because the bat signal is literally supposed to be a bat, like, with its wings, even though it kind of looks like vampire teeth. Yeah.
But when you're mentioning Sirius, it would take me over a month to do right. But after watching the movie Solaris, there is a post, like a massive blog post that I have in me, that wants to point out the thematic connections between 2001: A Space Odyssey, Solaris, Planet of the Apes, and Contact. And I feel like I know.
Don't forget Donnie Darko.
There's such a straight through line that it's kind of dumbfounding to me.
Alan, watch The Box with Cameron Diaz. Trust me.
Okay.
It's like the next piece of I need to watch it again. It was a total mindfuck. But it's like the sequel to Donnie Darko. And it's like so in line with everything we've been fucking talking about. I haven't been talking about it because I don't want to spoil anything and I want to have a conversation. And so I think that would make for a really good show as well.
All right, I'll tell you what. I'll watch The Box, you watch Solaris.
Oh, I've seen Solaris. I've seen both versions of it. I love it. But I'll watch it again. Is it Visconti? Yeah,
Go ahead.
Was it Visconti who did Solaris? I forget.
I think Tartovsky.
Yeah, Tartovsky. Yeah.
Beautiful movie, but also I couldn't, like, the movie, so obviously this comes out, I think, 1972, and what was 2001: A Space Odyssey is 1968, but it's based on a book. I don't know what year the Solaris book came out, but what stunned me is they're talking about flying low over this Technicolor ocean and then seeing this giant blue-eyed baby floating over water. And if you consider the end of 2001: A Space Odyssey, he flies over this Technicolor ocean and then ends up with this giant blue-eyed baby floating there. Things like that, which I was like, okay, that's really interesting. And then there's, as I said, like they're really playing up the third degree, like tracing board, where they mention Acadia trees more than once, and one of the final shots is what looks like a little coffin with a sprig sticking up out of it, which is the third degree tracing board. Then you have the obvious connections to Sirius and things like that. Again, it would probably take me a month to do right to get all the screen captures or whatever, but it's pretty incredible. I feel like there is such a straight through line. Yeah, I don't exactly know what to say.
Oracle Solaris 11 Cloud Operating System. Huh.
What is that?
I'm just Googling Solaris. It's Solaris 11 by Oracle Cloud Operating System.
Is that like HARP or something? Cloud Operating System?
Some computer thing from Oracle.
Listen, guys, I actually got to get going because my roommates are just headed out the door and I need to connect with them before they split. But it's been beautiful connecting, and I'd love to just maintain the dialogue over time. Like, anytime you guys want to get back together and keep talking, I'd be interested.
Please, yeah. And if you got to run, but just to say, there is an episode of Synchronized that should be coming out in the next few days. Andres and I just keep kind of revising it and making it cleaner, but Ezra does a Tone Color Alchemy breakdown of
Lou Reed song that's really fantastic that I actually want to talk about it with this another time. But everyone keep an eye out. There should be a synchronized episode 5 should be coming very soon.
I'll be looking forward to that. Great.
Awesome. Yeah, it was great talking to you guys. So we'll just kind of...
Well, awesome.
All right.
Okay, great.
And Melissa's telling me she's getting out of work, so I should probably split as well. She wants me to come meet her. So,
all right.
Well, good timing then.
Yeah, Michael, thank you for joining us. I appreciate talking to you as always.
Yep.
Well, thank you for having me. It was fun and stimulating as usual. So
keep holding on to the feather. Or is the idea to throw the feather away and know you don't need it?
Yeah, no, you don't need it anymore. I don't know. So, well, I just wanted to end that I have a lot of 747 syncs that keep popping up, and it's become an important number for me. And one of the reasons I've been using Dumbo is because he's Harpocrates, he's the baby Horus, because he's dumb or mute, and his mother is Dumbo, and 747 is a jumbo jet. And so whenever I see a jet, a 747, that means I've seen an elephant fly.
Look at that house, Dumbo. You're standing on the threshold of success. Don't look down, it'll make you dizzy. Boy, are they in for a surprise? Got the magic feather? Good. Okay. Contact! Take off! Uh-oh! The magic feather! Dumbo! Come on, fly! Open the mirrors! The magic feather was just a gag! You can fly! Honest, you can! Hurry! Open them up!
there's, I don't know, in New York they started to do this sort of real estate scheme where they would rename these traditionally unpopular areas to kind of gentrify them and, you know, make the real estate price go up. And there's an area in Brooklyn that they renamed Dumbo, and I don't know if there might be a sink waiting for you there. But
I have heard of that just being used around. I didn't know that it was a real estate renaming plan. Huh?
Yeah, it's called District Under Manhattan Bridge Overpass.
That's kind of the under over.
Under the bridge, over the bridge.
Yeah, that is interesting.
That is right next to the Brooklyn Bridge, the road to Oz in The Wiz. So.